Perilous times. The world witnessed the seemingly endless wars and conflict that had left nearly a third of the world's population dead, more than 2.5 billion people. The negative environmental impact was staggering. More than a third of the sea creatures had been killed through the wars. The many major catastrophes that had taken place, the land had not fared any better. More than a third of the livable land had been destroyed. Trees, crops, grass, general vegetation, huge sections of the world were simply denuded. Even the night sky, even the day sky had been altered. Dust and debris from the wars, the environmental disasters had filled the sky so that even the midday sun was darkened and the night sky looked blank because the light from the stars in the heavens were blocked. And then it happened, an invasion that seemed to come from space. The Hollywood movies that for years had given the world stories of what aliens might be like did the reality no justice. Just as the invasion was happening, hundreds of thousands of corpses erupted from their graves. But even before the fear of those who witnessed this event began to subside, those resurrected beings disappeared into the clouds. What was that all about? And then the wars started again. Millions died, but it seemed to be only those that had embraced the world-ruling government that had risen to dominance in the last number of years over all the nations of the earth. More sea animals died. The war that followed, huge sections of the sea simply turned to blood. It was a truly scary time. The wars that had brought the billions of deaths in the 3 years were the result of many wars fought between the nations of Europe and a confederation of nations of Asia. Now the armies of those former adversaries combined their military might to fight this new threat as they perceived it from outer space. They had gathered in a place not too far from Jerusalem called Megiddo to fight this alien army. What they never considered as a possibility was that they would never defeat this alien force. In a flash, those armies simply disappeared. The collective fear of the people of the world leading up to this defeat was that the alien force had come to wipe off all life from the land. But that didn't happen either, and the world didn't end. Rather, the hatred, the rush to death, the anger of the world's collective animosity towards anything moral, anything perceived as seeking a level of righteousness began to dissipate. Something almost intangible had changed. It was as if a truly evil force had simply been removed. In fact, the aliens from outer space seemed to be here to help mankind. The leader of this alien force glowed in presence. His face and his clothes radiated light. The army that he had brought with him were in similar appearance and attitude. And they began healing people. They began providing for the immediate needs of those that had survived all of these terrible events and who had lived through a war in a time like no other. A new chapter in mankind's history had been turned. While much of the world expected these victorious aliens to make slaves of the human race, they rather began to teach mankind how to live in peace, how to live in harmony, how to treat the land the way God intended. They used an ancient text that had been so marginalized in the late 20th and early 21st centuries that most had never even read it. The text was, of all things, the Bible. There's no doubt that we live in perilous times, and events will only get worse as we get deeper into the end time. We can see the beginnings of political events that could lead up to some of these end time tribulation events, but we are here on the eve of the beginning of God's Feast of Tabernacles, a time that pictures a millennial reign of Jesus Christ, and it will be a truly unprecedented time in mankind's history. For the first time ever, mankind as a whole will be taught to live according to God's way of life. And while Satan will have been removed by that time, by the beginning of the fulfillment of this day, his influence does not immediately disappear. What does this Feast of Tabernacles mean to you? Is it simply a utopian idea? Is the millennium a time for us to rest and simply rejoice that we are no longer physical? Do you see yourself working beside Christ and his saints to teach mankind how to live, to teach mankind how to restore the physical creation that had been destroyed, to teach them what God really wants and what he intended for mankind all along? What will the millennium be like? We're going to take a brief look at this tonight and set the stage for many wonderful messages that are going to follow this week. And I'd like to begin in Isaiah 11. This is a wonderful section of scripture, and we touch on it regularly, and rightly so, because it pictures a time that mankind has never experienced since the Garden of Eden. A time when even nature, the animals, will be at peace. Isaiah 11 and verse 6 says, "The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and the child shall lead them." There's no way this will happen now. These animals would eat each other. They would tear at each other. Verse 7, "The cow and the bear shall graze together. The young ones shall lie down together. The lion shall eat straw like an ox. Even the very nature of what sustains them will be changed. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole. The weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. And they shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain." Not any part of nature, nor any part of mankind's doings. Because as it finishes there in the verse, "For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the eternal as the waters cover the sea." Everything that will be done moving from this day when it's fulfilled, moving forward, will be done under the direction, the foundation of God's word. Does anybody not really want this reality? Even carnal individuals that would have never read this before, if we would read this to them, I doubt that there's anybody that would not say, "That's a nice picture. I would love to be there." In a world filled with such scary events and circumstances as the vision of peaceful future is given to us, in spite of all of that, it is a powerful reassurance of the hope of the future that we have. But have you ever asked yourself how long it will take for this to truly take place? What we've just read here in Isaiah, will it happen immediately? Christ returns and ends all of those end time events, all those destructive events that take place, the death and the tribulation that goes on. The armies fighting his return are put down. God's government is begun. It's begun to be reestablished here on earth. Satan has been removed. The healing of the nations and the earth begins. But how long until these verses begin to be fulfilled? We can think, we can hope that it's like a switch and immediately it's done. Mr. Armstrong speculated years ago that it would probably take about 3 generations for the sins of the fathers to dissipate, if you will. Think about why that might be the case. We have approaching 6,000 years of mankind's influence. The way we think, the way we act, the way the world behaves, everything that we founded the governments on that we have, the economies that we have, everything is based on Satan's foundation. Direct and indirectly. That won't disappear overnight. The survivors into the millennium will have a lifetime of habits and choices of human nature to overcome. How hard is it for us to change a habit, any habit? Let's go next to Ezekiel 38. We're given a glimpse into the future in this chapter, and we don't turn to it very often. Rather, we like the chapter previous. In Ezekiel 37, we have the vision of the Valley of Dry Bones and all of those lives raised up. That'll be touched on later in the feast. But in chapter 38, then Ezekiel goes to a different part of the vision. And so in verse 1 it says, "Now the word of the Eternal came to me, saying, Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach and Tubal and the prophecy against him and say, thus says the eternal God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, and lead you out with your army, your horses and horsemen, all splendidly clothed, a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. When is this? When is this going to take place? Verse 5, Persia, Ethiopia, Libya are with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer with all of his troops, the house of Targama from the far north and its troops. Many people are with you. Prepare yourself and be ready. You and all your companies are gathered about you and guard. Be a guard for them. After many days you will be visited, and in the latter years you will come back to the land of those brought back from the sword, gathered from many people in the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate. They were brought out of the nations, and now all of them will dwell safely. You will ascend, coming like a storm, covering the land like a cloud, and all of your troops and many peoples with you. And thus says the eternal God, on that day it shall come to pass that thoughts will arise in your mind, and you will make an evil plan. You will say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to a peaceful people who dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates. To take plunder, to take booty, to stretch your hand out against the waste places that are again inhabited, and against the people who gathered from the nations, who have acquired livestock and goods, who dwell in the midst of the land. Sheba, Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish, and all their young lions will say to you, have you come to take plunder? Have you gathered your army to take booty, to carry away our silver and gold, to take away livestock and goods, to take great plunder? Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say to Gog, thus says the eternal God, on that day, when my people Israel dwell safely, will you not know it? Then you will come from your place out of the far north, you and many peoples with you, all of them riding on horses, a great company and with a mighty army, and you will come up against my people Israel like a cloud to cover the land. It will be in the latter days that I will bring you against my land so the nations may know me when I am hallowed in you, O Gog, before their eyes. Again, when is this? We read of a time when these nations are armed for war. And yet we read in there as well that it's a time of unwalled cities, of peace and prosperity. Scholars debate the timing of this. Theological scholars, some think that this was the Jews in the 1940s. Gathering, going to the Middle East and establishing the modern nation of Israel. But they see that as a precursor to the return of Christ. But that doesn't fit the modern context of how this nation came to be. Some say this is Armageddon, right before Christ returns. And there is some parallel. Many of the same nations, many of the same actions and attitudes are going to be prevalent there. But as you think about that question, let's turn to Revelation 20. Revelation 20, the logical conclusion is that after the millennial begins is when this war that we read about in Ezekiel 38 will take place. That seems rather odd, doesn't it? That a time of great peace and hope when God will establish his government, that there'd be such a war. Revelation 20 and verse 7. Now when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison. When the 1,000 years are finished, why would God do that? For 1,000 years, Satan had been removed. For 1,000 years, God had showed mankind what was possible under his rulership with his law as a foundation for everything that was done. A time of unprecedented peace and harmony. A time of Isaiah 11, when even the animals will coexist peacefully. Let's continue here in Revelation 20 and verse 8. And he will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sands of the sea. We read some of that in Ezekiel 38. That in spite of all that God has helped established through his word, through his son, through his saints, all of the good that has been done, as amazing as it seems, there will still be people who say, I don't want that. Verse 9, They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. Fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Verse 10, the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone with the beast and the false prophet, should be translated were. They were physical beings long since consumed by the fire. And it says, and they will be tormented night and day forever. Those who have that mindset will not exist. How can we have a war at the beginning and at the end of the millennium? The simple answer is that God will not lock down society, if I can use that term. He will not control mankind so that no contrary view can be considered. Why would he do that? Why would he not put his fist down and say, I will not tolerate dissenting ideas? Even though mankind will have access to Christ and will experience firsthand all of the blessings of God's way of life, he will not make anyone choose that way of life unwillingly. They have to want it. For the first time, though, in mankind's history, people will have a clear contrast, though, of life versus death, right versus wrong, the way of God versus Satan's way of death, and even more importantly, they will be given encouragement and direction to choose God's way. Let's look at that back in Isaiah 30. It's not that God is going to be hands-off. You and I'm convinced, will be very busy during this time, the fulfillment of this holy day, the week that we're going to observe here. I think you and I will be very active in not waiting for problems to rise up and for them to get ahead, but rather you and I will be actively teaching people when we begin to see things go wrong, to direct them to the right way. Isaiah 30 and in verse 20, though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be removed into a corner anymore, but your eyes shall see your teachers. How often do we hear any questions that challenge what's being done and why we can't figure out a better way? No one stops and says, why is this not working? Instead, humanly, we double down. More money, more time, different set of leaders. If we put more whatever behind it, we'll succeed. And yet it doesn't ever get better. It just gets worse. The teachers that God would put in place, the world doesn't want to hear right now. Look at how increasingly any thought that comes from Scripture is not only marginalized, it is actively suppressed. To continue then, in verse 21, your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it, whenever you turn to the right hand, whenever you turn to the left. I think the reason why they'll hear this word behind them is that we will be walking alongside them. We'll be talking to them. What's the instruction back in Deuteronomy as parents to their children? Teaching them when they walk in the way, when they lie down, when they go here and there. We will be doing the same thing with the world, teaching them God's way, understanding what they're thinking because we've been there. That God will give us insight and we'll be able to say, I know what you're thinking. And it might seem reasonable, but let me remind you where it all went when the world was going the same direction. Maybe we'll share even experiences from our own life and say, look, I know firsthand how that played out and you don't want that. But it's interesting to consider that even in the millennium, verse 20, there's going to be adversity and there's going to be affliction. Yes, it will be an unprecedented time in man's history, but it's not a utopia where there are no issues, no conflict, no troubles to overcome. Otherwise, the teachers wouldn't be moved into the corner. Even then, you're going to have people that aren't going to want to listen initially. We know, as we read from Ezekiel 38, even at the end of the millennium, I've always found that very astounding, that after 1,000 years of peace and prosperity, you're going to have people so bent on rebelling against God that they think they can succeed. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 2 next. What is God's purpose in the millennium? Is it to make it a Garden of Eden? That will happen as a consequence of the righteousness that will be taught and lived. But is that the purpose? We know from other prophecies, it talks about the plowman overtaking the reaper, that the land will be so healthy, the produce so amazing in terms of quantity, there will not be enough time to collect it all before it's time to plant again. But is that the purpose? I believe the purpose is the same as it is today. Hebrews 2 and verse 10. I've read this quite a lot recently in my congregations because to me this succinctly says what it is God's trying to do. For it was fitting for him, speaking of Jesus Christ, for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings, in bringing many sons to glory. The plan of God is not finished yet, as this day begins in fulfillment. There's still 1,000 years, and how many people will live into that time period? Several billion? And how many wait in their graves? We have no idea. The plan of God is not done. There's still a lot that needs to be taken care of. You and I still have a lot of work to do under the direction of Jesus Christ and the Father. That Christ came for this perfect, this reason, to become even more perfect and to bring many sons to the glory of God. Let's turn to 2 Peter 3 and verse 9. The world has a very jaded view of God. Even in Christianity, most think, as they read the Old Testament, God was a very capricious God. He was a very angry God. He was a God that seemed to like and be satiated by death, blood, whether it was in sacrifices or whether it was in nations God told Israel to just wipe out. That's not the picture of God at all. What they're missing in there is the reason why that needed to be. The sin that was brought upon the world. But God's view, rather, is 2 Peter 3 and verse 9. The Lord is not slacking concerning his promises, as some count slackness. Some today even read the Bible and they say, look, none of that's happened. It'll never happen. It's just a bunch of myths written by men over time, edited to suit their purposes to control people. There's no value in any of it. But God's not slack. How patient and merciful is God? How long has he waited for his plan of salvation for mankind to play out? How much has he tolerated, hoping that everyone that has been born will be in his family? The Lord is not slack concerning his promises, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering towards us. Very patient. How many hundreds of years did he wait for the Amalekites to change, even though they never did? How many years did he wait for the Egyptians to change, even though they kept Israel in slavery? How many years did God wait for us to finally begin to pay attention to what he's trying to teach us? He's not willing, as it says here, that any should perish, not one person. He wants all of mankind to have what you and I will picture this week. The messages that you will hear, the musical selections that you will hear, the prayers that will be given, the conversations that you will have. Does it all point to this? Think about that as you hear these messages and ponder what it is that we would be able to do under the direction of Jesus Christ to be an assistant in this. Who would you like to have a conversation with to change their way of thinking that they could have this? The way this will happen 2 Peter 3:9, the way this will take place and be fulfilled is primarily through individuals making godly decisions in spite of the pressure to do otherwise. It's no different today, is it? How many of you have faced hard, hard trials this past year? Loss of loved ones, loss of income, breakups of families, financial trials, pressure in so many other ways. How many of you had a hard time even getting here because of obstacles that were placed in your way? God allows these things so that we have to choose. It's the very same thing he told Adam and Eve. It's the very same thing he told the children of Israel. Choose life. You have a choice, he says. You can choose death. That's not what I want. We read this right here in 2 Peter 3:9. He's not willing that any should perish. Satan will be bound at the beginning of the millennium, but as I said, it'll probably take several generations for that influence to wane. The result of his influence, the pattern of thinking in individuals' minds, that doesn't go away right away. Yes, it will drop off dramatically. Things will begin to change right away. But the interesting thing is when you remove something negative, people don't change their minds right away. Otherwise, everybody coming out of prison would be on the right footing. It takes a willingness to make a decision to say, I'm not going to do that. It's human nature, though, to not want our children to face the same adversities we have. More than one social commentary has made the observation that the generation of World War II were very tolerant of their children, wanted them to have a life they didn't have, to not face difficulties they had to face. And many have made the connections that as a result we had the 1960 social upheavals that we had. But there's only one way to get character. And as I've touched on already, it's learning right from wrong, making right the choice, and exercising the will to continue in the right. Simply put, very hard to do, isn't it? But a muscle develops only with resistance. And character is no different. While there will be many blessings connected to the millennium, there are still the cares and aspects of human nature, a mind of man not yet made spirit. Exposed to it, but not yet made spirit. Still challenged by that way of thinking in opposition to God. But God uses that to develop character. As parents, we encourage our children to do the very thing, don't we? We try to teach them how to make right decisions. We give them opportunities within parameters, depending on how old they are. So they begin to learn. I don't see why God would do anything differently with mankind in general. Think of the aspects of overcoming that you've made in your life. We're not spirit yet, are we? The challenges, I believe, with human nature are not going to be much different in the millennium. Just a much better environment in which to make them. Human beings will still have the ability to make choices in the kingdom of God. That means right choices, but it also means wrong choices. Remember what we read in Ezekiel 38. The really curious thing to me is God knows what they're doing. Will he just wait on the sidelines or will he not have a conversation with them? In my mind, he did the same thing with Satan. I don't believe he just let him get angry and angry and angry and never had the conversation with him. I think Satan got more angry and angry and angry in spite of God's conversations with him. Maybe we'll be the part of the ones having the conversation saying, are you really sure you want to do this? This is not the right way to handle this. How can you repent if there's no opportunity for sin? Doesn't mean God's going to encourage it. He's going to set them up to fail. That's not what I mean. But sin really isn't physical, is it? The fruits, the actions are. Sin begins in the mind. Currently, most of the world lives below the line we here in this country, in spite of the troubles we can see in our lives, the difficulties, the trials, whatever circumstances we struggle under, we live like kings compared to the rest of the world. But Satan pulls at the world, no matter what you have. It's never enough. What's acceptable, he seeks to kill. He seeks to marginalize. But in the millennium, everybody will have the opportunity to live above the line. Everybody will have what wealth is necessary. They'll have land. They'll have food. We won't be running hither and yon like we are today with this frantic pace. And quite frankly, even many in the medical field say that most of our modern illnesses are due to our lifestyles, the pace of life that we're in, the stress that we put in ourselves. Let's turn next to Matthew chapter 18. There's much to consider in this, and I'm not saying that the millennium is not a wonderful time, but sometimes we can think that it's done. If we can just make it to that point, it's done, and it's not. But that doesn't mean that it isn't going to be a wonderfully marvelous time. Matthew 18 and verse 21, we have the parable here of the unforgiving servant. And Peter came to him, it said, and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times? Now, in the Jewish culture of the day, Peter was very generous. He thought he was being magnanimous here. And Jesus answered and said, I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven. He exponentially multiplied the number. It's not that we can stop at 490. The point is, as often as it is necessary. So he gives them a parable. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he had begun to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. Huge sum. This individual probably could have never in his lifetime paid this back. But as he was not able to pay, his master commanded he be sold, and his wife and his children, all that he had, and payment be made. And the servant therefore fell down before him, saying, Master, have patience with me, and I will pay you. He begged for mercy. I will do everything in my power, he said, to make this right. So the master of the servant was moved with compassion, released him, and forgave the debt. He didn't say, okay, talk to my assistant, we'll set up a payment schedule. He said, okay, it's done. You don't owe me a dime. But verse 28, that servant went out and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii, a small, insignificant sum compared to his debt. Took him by the throat and said, pay me what you owe me. The contrast couldn't be more stark. The mercy that he'd been extended is like it never existed in his mind. So his fellow servant did the same thing he had done to his master. He fell down at his feet. He begged him, saying, have patience with me, and I will pay you all. And he would not, but went and threw him into prison, which is a really odd thing. How's he going to pay him? So when his fellow servants saw what had been done, they were very grieved. They came and told their master what had been done. And his master, after he called him, said, you wicked servant, what do you think you're doing? I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. Should you not have had compassion on your fellow servants, just as I had pity on you? There's something in our human nature that wants a pound of flesh when we feel wronged. But that's not what God is looking for. Let's put ourselves in this picture. How many times have we, as a servant, gone to God as our master and said, please forgive me? What would happen if one day he said, no? We'd have no recourse, would we? Should we not forgive our fellow servants just as much as God forgives us? Will this not need to be learned? Look at the problems in the world that would be solved if individuals simply applied this parable. Who's going to teach the world? You and I. Is tolerance for others going to cease in the kingdom? Will there not be any contention? How does Gog and Magog get to a point where they say, we're going to go and conquer these people and take everything they have? Why? A perceived hurt? A loss? Some injustice they think needs to be righted? I don't know. But they let it build to a point where they're willing to act on it. Let's move over to chapter 22, Matthew 22, verse 1. We have the parable of the wedding feast. Christ spoke again by parables and said, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son and sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding, and they were not willing to come. This was not just any wedding. This was the king. And they said, no, I've got something better that day. So again, he sent out other servants saying, tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner, my oxen, my fatted cattle are killed. All things are ready. Come to the wedding. You don't have to bring anything. I will take care of all needs, he says. But they made light of it and went their ways. One to his farm, another to his business. The rest seized his servants, treated them spitefully and killed them. It wasn't enough to say no thanks. When the king heard about it, he was furious. And he sent out his armies and he destroyed those murderers and burned up their cities. And he said to his servants, the wedding is ready, but those who are invited are not worthy. You and I have been invited to a wedding. This week pictures. We were not worthy. There are a whole lot of people in the world that are a lot more talented, a lot more smart, a lot more sophisticated, a lot more of everything. But that's not what God is looking for. He's looking for individuals who want to be in his family. And for whatever reason right now, he invited us. He'll talk to the rest of the mankind later. We'll cover that later as well this week. So verse 9, he says, therefore go to the highways, as many as you find, invite to the wedding. Those servants went out to the highways and gathered together all of whom they found, both good and bad, and the wedding was filled with guests. God will call in the millennium, just like he's calling now. But he'll do it on a greater scale. Percentage-wise, we're not even a fraction of percent of the world's population. In the millennium, everyone will have the opportunity. But will it be in casual clothes or will it be with wedding garments? Is it possible for the kingdom to come, to even be in the millennium, and for individuals to not want to be there? Maybe they're there because they have no choice, they think, but they don't want to be there. It takes time for a tree to grow, for fruit to be produced. It takes time for bread to rise. We live in such an instant world. We forget. We're impatient when the microwave takes 30 seconds. We want everything now. Let's go to Daniel chapter 2 next and look at one of the prophecies. God always starts small and he builds. And even with the millennium, not everything is going to be taken care of right away, because he wants effort from those that are going to be there. He wants individuals to want what he has to offer, to value it as he does, and to make it theirs. Daniel 2 and verse 34. This is Daniel's vision being explained to him. And to break into the thought, verse 34, Daniel 2, he says, you watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them into pieces. If you remember the golden image, and it was made of gold on the top, silver in the middle, bronze on the bottom, and then mixture of iron, clay in the feet. We know that that pictures the various world governments down through time. And so Daniel saw in his vision this stone that came down and smashed all of this. It says, then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff in the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. God's government is not going to try to repair the governments of this world. God's government is not going to try to build on top of what mankind has built. God is going to sweep the floor and he's going to start fresh. And notice, the stone struck the image and became a great mountain. God starts small and he builds big. What's your role in the fulfillment of this week? What will you be doing? Will you even be there? On trumpets, it was very inspiring. There were a number of us that touched on a point locally where I'm from that talked about being in the kingdom so that we'd see those faithful saints that had already died. Do you want to be there to work us alongside those individuals? I'm not talking even the faithful of Scripture. That'll be amazing on its own, but I want to see my grandfather. I want to see many others. I'm not talking again, just to be clear, I'm not talking about the kingdom not being a marvelous time. But it will not be the world that it is now. But we'll still have to deal with the attitudes. We'll still have to overcome and teach those that are there to overcome. Revelation 21, let's go there next as we begin to wrap up here. The point I'm making is that everything is a process. We so yearn for this world to be over. We're so aware of the limitations. When I kneel before God with another individual or a couple or whoever it happens to be, when they ask for anointing, I'm reminded of how tenuous life is and how easily these bodies fail us. And that it's not meant to be forever. This life, this body. God gave us life so we could learn to live. Revelation 21 and verse 4. God will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, and the former things are passed away. When is this? It's not at the beginning of the millennium. It's not at the end of the millennium. This doesn't happen until after the last great day. Because as we read earlier, there's still death. There's still war. And there's still a whole lot of wrong attitudes, even at the end of the millennium. And even in the last great day, will everyone choose to live God's way of life? I have no idea what the percentages will be. But we're told that there are individuals that would choose to die rather than submit to God, and they will be ashes under our feet. No more. This doesn't happen until after all are either in God's family or not. Will we be there? Awful lot of people that I grew up with, awful lot of individuals that I, to use the term Paul did, sat at their feet, that I was instructed by them, that I've been connected with God's church for almost 50 years now. Not all of them are around anymore, and not all of them stayed faithful until the end. We have a great calling in front of us. We have a wonderful time pictured in the coming week. We yearn for that time because we're done with this world. I am. But I know there's still more to do. We're not able to walk away yet. God is still setting the stage to show mankind his power, his authority, and for Satan to be vanquished in the proper way. God is still working out his plan of salvation. And while the millennium will be a time of unprecedented peace and harmony in mankind's history, it will not be the complete fulfillment of what God has in store for those who he will make part of his family. It's the next step. And it's amazing what will happen. But there's still more. Last verse in Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians 2 and verse 19. Now, therefore, you who are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, and whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord. a building that grows together. You and I have a part to play now, this coming week, the weeks to come, the years to come, as we rehearse each Sabbath, as we rehearse each holy day season, year after year. Are we working to this? Are we building on this? We have opportunity to do so this week. I encourage you to share whatever you have, and even if it's only your time or a conversation, reach out to those that you see are by themselves, to the children that don't have both parents here, to the families that are struggling, to have the conversation to find out that you may think you're the only one struggling until you hear somebody else's problems. That we can pray for one another, that we can encourage one another, that we can strengthen one another as we hear the messages this week, and we can know that God indeed is God and He will see us through if we just remain faithful, if we do our part to yield to Him, if we take what we have been given and use it to change and to put aside our human nature and to become like Him. The millennium is not the finish line. Not for us, even though we're spirit, it's still not the finish line. It's just the beginning. There are billions of individuals yet to teach God's way of life. There are billions of individuals that will be raised from the grave, that will be stunned. They have no idea what's going on, to be taught, to be directed, to begin to know how to live. We'll hear messages about some of that this coming week. The great hope mankind has in all of this. The millennium will be a wonderful time that will make the best this current world has to offer look insignificant by comparison. It will be an unprecedented time in human history with peace and harmony and prosperity in a proper way. It will all be done under following God's instruction, but it will also be a time of teaching. It will be a time of leading and directing. You and I are learning that now. God's saints will teach with Christ under His leadership. Trials are there for us to learn how to be like God. We have a work to do. We have a work to do now. We have a work to do in the future. Let's make the most of these coming days. Get the sleep you need. Come ready to listen and learn. Ask questions of the men that present these messages in the right way. Challenge each other in your conversations that we will take this to heart and make it real so that you and I can be there in these verses when they're fulfilled, so that you and I will be able to rule effectively with Jesus Christ and God the Father in the millennium.